Motherfuckers, Hodo, what up, Yodo? Our mission is noble. Yeah, wanna be a mogul. My tindy's going global. Build an empire, Constantinople. You mean Istanbul? Get icy like Froyo. All gotta stay vocal. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Hodo. AMC, GameStop, YOLO. The hedgies short squeeze with ease, but they say no pump and dumps, please. What?
Yes, folks, welcome to another Left Reckoning. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, brother.
And that was Heather Morgan, a.k.a. RazzleCon. More on her later in the evening. She is party to the largest financial seizure ever.
Pretty incredible.
DOJ history. put numbers on the boards, RazzleCon. But first, we have a very, very exciting show for you tonight. We have Mike Prisner of the Empire Files, anti-war activist, Iraq war veteran. We're going to talk a lot of pertinent topics, I would say. We're going to get his understanding of the Ukraine situation with Russia and the historical split that can occur in the anti-war factions between liberal and anti-imperialist segments. And also we'll get a little bit of the libertarian anti-war flavor with Rand Paul, heinous position on the freezing the assets of Afghanistan. And we have another interview, Andrew Hinn, that David conducted. And we also are talking a little bit about false consciousness.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that Andrew Harrison, definitely stick around for that interview. He's running for Justice of the Peace here in Austin on a very, very interesting, radical, humane campaign to bring power back to working people. I really enjoy talking to him about, one, his campaign, but also how he's thinking of how it fits into this larger project that we're all involved in, which is building the power of the socialist movement and the working class movement as well. So definitely checked out his campaign. We put a link to his campaign website below, and stick around for that interview as well.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. And then, you know, I think in between that, we might talk a little bit about this big theft, because the Bitcoin people make it a little bit too easy.
I mean, they made some content, and that content is king when you have a side, you know, project as a rap sort of influencer and our young CEO. And not only that, a prolific contributor to Forbes Women. It's, you know,
that's amazing.
And then you put up $4.5 billion in stolen crypto, bitcoins. That wasn't that much when they stole it. And I need to say, the DOJ is insane that they stole it. I think everyone's inferring that, but the allegation is that they're trying to launder it through, like, you know, Walmart gift cards and other sorts of Bitcoin platforms.
Just, yeah.
But it is a fun story. We got some fun video of that. RazzleCon, yeah.
Yeah. No, we'll get into it. And I'll just say at the top, you know, like, we don't try to focus too much on the Bitcoin stuff, just because it's like, it's very fun and funny, but we try to make this also a little bit of a nutritious show for folks. But, you know, I really agree with our friend Edward Angueso, from This Machine Kills podcast, and Vice, that, like, you know, this stuff actually really does start to matter, because the people who are now starting to put large amounts of sums that they really can't afford into this stuff are, you know, marginalized folks, working class people who are seeing all of these billboards and signs that are telling them, invest, 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 invest in Bitcoin. It's a sure thing. And I think that this is where, you know, it starts to transform actually from us just sort of like roasting, you know, some really, you know, goofy folks, just saying, like, you know, we need to be looking out for people who are being taken advantage of right now, because it's not going away.
I mean, and it's a perfect example of what we're talking about. We have a bunch of basically stranded assets, dirty money, and it needs to find ways out. And of course, like we said that with, you know, that's what crypto was originally for, with buying drugs. So you have all this sort of cultural foam and just nonsense that basically tries to help, like, people like these idiots launder money. But you know what? They gave us some music, so.
Yeah, exactly. Well, before we get to our guests and everything, I did want to start this show with a commentary about something that very much affects the left and Marxists. There are kind of like liberal countercultural aspects of this phenomenon. But I think it's something that's very much worth addressing as we're in this moment of rebuilding and reimagining what we need to be doing in the future. You know, y'all might know the line. It's a pretty roaring and thunderous one at the end of the Communist Manifesto, right? Workers of the world unite. You've got nothing to lose but your chains. You know, and that can, you know, build up the spirit, make your cheeks a little bit red, get you excited. But the question, when you read that in 2022, it has to be asked. It's been since 1848, since that moment when this was written, and we're still waiting. Despite capitalism expanding and proletarianizing billions across the globe, it can sometimes feel like Marx and Engels were much closer in a way to a global workers' revolution than some of us living today, right? That system, the system of capitalism, of the dictatorship of the bosses and the rich, has become more powerful. But it's also become very much implanted in our daily lives and our common sense. I mean, most people don't recognize that this is not the natural order. This is something that we as human beings have created. You know, and capitalism has certainly subsumed so many other traditions, both culturally and spiritually. You know, one example is look at the churches in America. It's not like the churches have been sort of immune from getting caught up and making money and scams and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But look at the, you know, the traditional, for example, like Southern Baptist Church here. I mean, it feels very, very much like a business in the fullest sense, right? It's just amazing to see a tradition that's as old as that, thousands of years old, you know, become so incorporated into a capitalist system. I mean, right?
Look at the Falwells, right? The Righteous Gemstone inspirees.
No, I mean, no doubt about it, right? Like, this is what I'm saying. It's like, this is an old tradition. This is thousands of years old, and it just has become incorporated into capitalism in such a way that it might seem to some of us like it's always been this way, and that's not been the case, right? So in spite of all of this historic weight lining up to show that there's these problems with these systems, we're just not there yet when it comes to the radical movements to overcome it. This is why this is a question that any serious political thinker has to wrestle with, right? Despite all of the crimes and alienation and misery that you can see as a part of this system, why have we not been able to overcome it, right? The fact is that a socialist revolution is not just going to happen mechanically, automatically. That means that we actually have to build the conditions ourselves for change. And I think that is one thing that we understand a lot more today than maybe folks did a couple hundred years ago, that like, it's not just going to happen because things are going to get worse, right? We actually have to understand that we must play an active role in this movement. I preface this just to take people through like, you know, the most zoomed out lens version of why there is this kind of crisis in socialist and Marxist thought, right? You feel like we've pointed out the contradictions, things have only gotten worse since, for example, the Communist Manifesto was written, and we still have not seen a collective, you know, we've seen pockets of resistance and socialist revolutions for sure, but it hasn't been this kind of global world revolution that people were hoping for at that time. You know, so in the shift in hope, right, when people, particularly in the 1950s in the West, you know, started to feel like this revolution is not around the corner. In fact, that maybe it's a revolution that was denied, to us. Many did, and we still are in this era, they did what we call the cultural turn, right? The fight became not just about being against capitalism in general, organizing people into mass movements to challenge the system, implanting yourself into the labor movement, intellectually at least, it became about developing a critique of contemporary society and culture in the hope that this could, you know, unlock a key to the answer, right? Why the revolution hasn't happened yet. And I don't want to say that investigating mass culture and ideology, you know, is unimportant. It absolutely is. You know, we do that on this show as well. But I want to note one specific consequence of that I think is very pervasive, not just amongst the Marxists and socialists, it's across the board, particularly with liberals. But I wanted to point it out and show why it's a problem and sort of work our way out of it, if we could, at this time. Because I think it really is this kind of overcorrection that we had and turning towards culture and a critique of ideology in general, right? And the second bit, like, you know, this development and this kind of over-reliance in this kind of extremely condescending and unhelpful way that people think about the term called false consciousness. And I'll break down the history of that really quick, but just to give people kind of common sense understanding of what I mean by that, it's the kind of thought that a lot of, especially when you're younger and you start just to become a socialist, right? Like, you've had this realization about the system and you think that the thing that's sort of standing in between us and like mass socialist revolution is just that like your coworkers are just so brainwashed by society that they don't understand the problems.
You know, they don't,
and we need to wake people up, right? That's a very, very problematic place to be, both like personally and politically, and I'll break down why. But that's essentially what I mean by this kind of false consciousness discourse that a lot of people have. Is like, well, people don't know what's good for them, so we're going to tell them what they need to think and do, right? And let me break this down for y'all, right? Because if there's false consciousness, then there has to be a correct consciousness, and the correct consciousness is what we would call class consciousness. And what is class consciousness? I think there's a couple things that are very, very important to note. Class consciousness is not something that is necessarily innate. It is a possibility, but it is a process. It is something that we construct, right? Class consciousness is understanding your position as a member of a class, the working class, and having that understanding sort of govern your politics and your action, right? But if you think about this as just an individual level problem, you know, you'd be making a mistake because this is a class issue, right? The working class has the potential to be cognizant of themselves, to understand themselves as a class. And because of our radical nature, because of our position in the system as the people who basically produce it, make the system work for everyone else, but also do not get the benefits in the same way that the ruling class does, we have the potential to challenge a system, to eradicate it, to do something different. That's why the working class is the revolutionary class. And to be able to do that, we have to build what is called class consciousness, understanding yourself as not just an individual or a Texan or North Dakotan or American or whatever different identity that you have, understanding yourself first and foremost as a worker and a member of the working class, right? Because remember, class is not the only identity. Right. And it won't be the only identity. It's not the only community that you belong to, but it has the potential to focus our attention and to organize us as a movement, as a class, to the fundamental causes of our maladies and of our existence, which are the dictatorship of the rich, capitalism. False consciousness is a term that maybe some of you aren't familiar with, some of you are familiar with. While Marx did lay the groundwork for this, particularly in Volume 1 of Capital, the term doesn't show up in Marx's work. It shows up in Engels' work. And that doesn't mean that it's not a legitimate term. I'm just taking people through the history here. And Engels throws that term out in a letter to Franz Mehring. It's a prototype that you can find in Marx's writing on ideology. Essentially, ideology is the system that comes out of ideology is what makes the world make sense to us, right? Ideology is produced by the conditions on the ground, not solely, but the largest force in there are the kind of economic conditions. And that's where you get this kind of common sense understanding of the way the world works. That's how you get the naturalization of capitalism and the relations that we have, right? Where we obscure the relationship that we have between people into relationships between things, right? And, you know, that's ideology, and we can spend a lot of time talking about ideology. I don't want to get too focused on it because I wanted to focus on this false consciousness aspect of it, right? What is ideology for working people, and this is what the false consciousness is this kind of inversion that happens, right? This kind of common understanding of the society that we're in. Instead of seeing yourself as members of a community or of a class, you start to think of yourself as individuals. And when this ideology becomes really strong, you know, we start to develop this ideology around individualism, personal responsibility, frankly, kind of anti-solidarity stuff. Think about a term like, or phrase like, God helps those who help themselves, right? That's a very, very strong expression of a highly ideological statement. But I want to note two things, right? One, that is certainly false consciousness, right? So being able to recognize that and to address it is absolutely something that we need to be building the capacity to do. But also understand that in the absence of radical movements, in the absence of union power, labor power, community, all these kind of organizations, is it absurd that people create ways of thinking and advice that they give themselves and each other that are hyper individualistic, right? In the absence of collective action and in the absence of these kind of more communal movements, is it surprising that people have sort of created entire ideologies around the individual and how that's the only thing that's going to protect you, right? It's wrong, but we need to be able to understand where these things come from if we want to get out of this crisis, right? Because I want to talk about this a bit because I need to clear up some of the confusion around it. Ideology is a necessary thing in the sense that it helps us understand the world around us. It should not be surprising that an ideology has been developed to excuse the inexcusable, to justify the unjustifiable. But for many, many Marxists, the focus on ideology has become an impediment, right? To think that the reason that we are in crisis, the reason that we are not in power, the reason that the workers haven't risen up is just solely and purely ideological is a mistake, because that means that all we need to do is defeat the popular ideology through argument, reason, maybe media or art, right? Or a big spectacle, and that we would be in a revolutionary time. That's a huge mistake. That might work on a couple folks, but that is not the reason that we are in the moment, right? I don't want to be overly like deterministic about these things. Dealing with ideology and mass culture and these things does matter, but I think a lot of people fall into the trap of thinking it's the only thing that matters, right? It clearly blinds us when we're trying to answer the question, why does the working class not stand this kind of like over commitment, this over analysis of ideology blinds us when we're trying to answer the question, why does the working class not stand overwhelmingly with us in a radical revolutionary way? We have to move past this, right? The first problem with the false consciousness stuff is that it's extremely condescending to say, you don't know what you want. Me and my buddies do. We've been reading, journals together and, we figured out your problems for you, right? That's extremely condescending. The second major problem is that this blinds socialists from understanding what is actually happening within our class and how we can move forward, right? The kind of liberal formulation of this is, why does the working class vote against their interests, right? The question we should be asking ourselves is, why is the interest of the working class expressing itself in the ways that it currently is, right? Most notably, on this kind of working class interest thing is people think about Thomas Frank, right, who wrote the famous book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And he notes, to his credit, that more than anything, the blame should not be placed on voters, but on the Democratic Party, who gladly turn their backs on the working class in the state when they stop running on economic issues, healthcare, and redistribution. But we got to go much further than our progressive friends here, right? We have to work to understand what happens when people are faced with a seemingly pro-worker option, why workers don't choose it. Because two times now, for example, talking about Bernie Sanders, and yeah, it was close and it was rigged, et cetera. But Bernie Sanders was running on those things and he didn't win, right? We can break down all the reasons why, but it was there. Class consciousness is a process. It's building. It's not just our understanding. We have to be able to build the capacity to act, right? Because winning power, particularly in the state, is just the beginning of the revolution. Like, what did Bernie say? Bernie was always saying, if I come into power, we're going to need big mass movements to get any of the things I want to get, in place. That's the correct analysis, but we were not there. And we weren't building that, frankly, right, well enough, right? Think of another example in Alabama, in Bessemer. Amazon rigged the election and they cheated. But you know what people said after the fact? They said, we were afraid if we voted to join the union, we would lose our benefits, we would lose our insurance. And that could be, that's 100%. It's correct to say, like, well, no, the union will fight for you. The union would do all these things. But you know what? People didn't believe that you had the capacity to do it, right? You have to understand that people have these kind of analysis that they have, right? In the sense that, like, there's a short term, my job sucks, blah, blah, blah. But I know if I don't make a big stink, I can keep it and keep these certain things that I have. Versus the long term kind of more radical position, which is like, well, we have to fight now to ensure like a better future. What our job as socialists is to do is to build up the capacity to people so that we can convince working people in our communities, at our shops and things like that, that when we fight, we win, right? And until we change the material conditions, getting very focused on the kind of ideological, oh, we need to convince this person of this, this, and that, can be a huge, huge mistake. I want to get to our guest here, so I'll just close with this. Socialists are an active body in the working class, right? That means that, like, these are people who are socialists are committed, socialists and communists are committed to doing extra work. They're committed very, very much to this movement. And that means that we have to do the work of not just convincing people, for example, that, you know, your boss is abusing you, that, you know, universal healthcare will be better for you. You know, that being in a union is how you express your power, both individually and collectively, but also building the capacity to make those things a reality. You know, that means things like strike funds. That's when you say to somebody, you should join a union, you need to be able to provide for them so that if the boss comes with the full strength that the power that the bosses have, we can look out for each other, right? And union drives political campaigns and building organizations that can begin to direct and organize our power toward victory, right? We have to have this extra commitment to this as socialists to keep the flame alive in dark times when we're disorganized and fragmented as a movement. And for that reason, and that reason alone, we need to be able to understand what our task is. It's not to, like, awaken, you know, some kind of stupefied masses that doesn't understand what's happening. We need to not just be able to articulate our vision, but we have to start showing through mass movement and organization that we can win immediate victories and then win the world, right? And it's really understanding that, you know, it's not that people don't want things or think that their boss is an asshole or think that the power structures of the society aren't working in their favor. People do not believe that we have the plan or the capability to follow through on the things that we're promising. And until we start to really focus on that, we'll never get out of this quagmire, right? And that's why focusing so much, for example, on these kind of false consciousness or ideological things can be a huge impediment, especially when if it's preventing people from doing the actual on the ground kind of material analysis as to why, you know, we are not in power today, right? And that's my two cents to start off.
There you go. Well, there's a reason Benjamin Franklin sort of, like, waste not, want not got popular, right? Because that stuff is empowering, because if you're wanting, you don't waste stuff. And you have to figure out something that's more empowering than that. Well, let's get to our guest now. See him in the weigh-in room. He is an anti-war activist, Iraq war veteran, a producer at the Empire Files, which I can speak for David, we endorse. Wholeheartedly. Mike Preisner. Mike, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me, guys. Happy to be on.
All right. And I'm just going to, let's see if we can get your mic a little bit louder.
Yeah, sure. I don't want to take a
pause. Let's see. A little bit quiet. Yeah.
Is that cool? I can turn my gain up.
Yeah, let's get some more gain if we can. Oh, there we go.
Yeah, it's a lot better. Cool. Perfect.
Sweet.
All right. Yeah, so Mike, I saw this tweet that you posted in the context of somebody dunking on Tim Pool and Vaush over some sanctions stuff, and I think I found it really instructive and interesting, you know, way to think about this thing. So I wanted you to flesh this out for us. But you said this isn't just an online thing. In the Gulf War, the anti-war movement split between the anti-imperialist wing and a much larger liberal wing, which actually had mass marches under the slogan, sanctions, not war. U.S. sanctions then killed about a multiple Iraqis, mostly babies. Now, in the context of what's going on in Ukraine, like, I want your understanding of that to the best, you know, this is at Wednesday evening, February 9th, you know, things change. The most recent headlines I saw was, you know, Macron and Putin had talks, and Macron said, you know, we want to lower the temperature on this stuff. But any more up-to-date understanding you have on that? But also, tell us about this ideological split in the anti-war movement and why it's significant.
Yeah, well, I guess first, just the Russia situation. I mean, like many potential conflicts, this is one of those where if right now the U.S. just did nothing at all, nothing would happen. Russia is not planning to invade Ukraine. Russia's been pretty clear about this. Their troop movements are pretty clear about it. And in particular, the Ukrainian government has been very clear about it, specifically the Ukrainian Defense Ministry, which is saying this is not happening. Why is everyone talking about this in the U.S.? And it's been pretty funny to see all the U.S. bourgeois media, New York Times and others, having to, like, run around and write all these op-eds to be like, no, actually, Ukraine is wrong, and we are right that Russia is going to invade Ukraine. So Ukraine probably worried about them being the flashpoint for World War III. So they're very much trying to turn down the temperature as well. And, you know, this is really a long pattern. I mean, of course, the Cold War was a period where very much people thought that there was a chance of nuclear war and mutually assured destruction and bombs hitting American cities with nuclear warheads and bombs hitting Moscow with nuclear warheads. You know, it was a very scary time for people. And so out of that came an actual framework or architecture to resolve things diplomatically, to turn down temperature, to make sure that there wasn't an outbreak of nuclear war. And there was multiple treaties and guarantees that both Russia and the United States came to together. You know, one of those guarantees was the United States on multiple occasions promising NATO will not expand east. And now NATO has expanded pretty much all the way up to Russia, except for Ukraine. Notably, that being actually a common route since the times of Napoleon for invasions into Russia. Most notably, the Nazi invasion into the Soviet Union, which killed 27 million Soviets, 15 million of whom were Russian. And so I, like any country, you have some kind of security concerns and some kinds of red lines about national defense and what you will and will not allow. But back to those treaties, all of those treaties that were set up as frameworks to make sure that things would not escalate to the way that they did during the Cold War, all of these treaties, the United States left them, all of them. And so all of these things that were put in place that would guarantee that we wouldn't get to a place where World War III could start and it could be nuclear. The most significant one recently was in 2019, Trump tore up this intermediate range missile treaty. And the reason that plays into the situation in Ukraine, which the U.S. media, of course, will never say, is now that that treaty is gone, and of course, the U.S. effort to bring Ukraine into NATO, which is just the U.S.-controlled alliance of junior imperialist partners to the U.S. war machine, that would mean that now that that treaty is gone, which is the very first step to the U.S. putting missiles in Ukraine that have a 2-minute flight time to Moscow with nuclear warheads. And so I think that if any country put missiles with a 2-minute flight time to Washington, D.C. on the Canadian border, there would be some kind of escalated tensions there. But I think that the important thing is that this is completely a crisis of the U.S.'s making. If Russia is not going to invade Ukraine, and that's the end of it. But I think that people should remain vigilant because wars don't always start because leaders decide to start them. Wars, in particular, World War I, they start just as like a series of escalating tensions, and they almost can start accidentally. So all of these things that Biden is doing, sending more troops to Europe, doing expanding B-52, which drops nuclear weapons, expanding flight areas of B-52 bombers, scrambling jets to Russian aircraft, doing aggressive naval operations. I mean, these are all things that could accidentally start a war just because of the U.S.'s own belligerence. And a war with Russia should concern people because the United States and Russia are the two biggest nuclear armed powers in the world. And so it's not a war that we want the reckless politicians in the United States starting just because, you know, I don't know why they kind of created this crisis. Maybe to, I don't know if you have thoughts on it, but maybe to distract a little bit from how bad Biden is doing and his, you know, so they needed something there. But I guess to back to this issue of sanctions, I mean, as we've seen this war escalation and the real absurdity of thinking about, you know, going to war with Russia, even if they sent troops into Ukraine, which is, you know, on their border, you know, you've heard this renewed call for, you know, you don't have to go to war. You can use sanctions to punish a country instead. And that was the reference to my tweet because I think it was being shared in the context of people like Tim Pool. And I think it came from a Vouch stream saying that we can just sanction. Yeah. Right. Okay. So yeah, we can sanction the hell out of them. Like we don't have to go to war with them. You know, that's not like a new idea. I mean, and so the history of the anti-war movement against the Gulf War is there was a huge upsurge against the the 1990-91 war against Iraq. The U.S. hadn't really seen a big war in a very long time, really since Vietnam, where it was defeated. And so there was, even in the military, I mean, there was thousands of deserters and conscientious objectors when the Gulf War started. People were just like, I'm out of here. And even a couple mutinies, which are pretty interesting that we don't have time for. But the anti-war movement was huge. It was surging. It was in the streets. And there was this liberal wing that came into the leadership that adopted this slogan, sanctions, not war. And it was so pervasive that I was at like 6 years old at the time. I remember writing a letter to President George H.W. Bush saying, don't go to war with Iraq. You can just stop sending them food instead. Because my mom, who was interested in the anti-war movement, that was the anti-war literature that reached her. It's like, you know, they weren't showing it on TV. There is no internet. But she was reached by liberal forces in the anti-war movement saying, this is the demand. We need everyone to write to the president and say, withhold food and medicine from Iraq instead of going to war. And this was considered the liberal peace position. But it actually caused a split in the movement where there were separate marches, where there was marches literally under the banner, sanctions, not war. And there was opposing demonstrations led by communists that said no war in Iraq, which is a much better slogan. And I think that, of course, the, you know, people, when they think of sanctions, they think of like, we're sanctioning Putin and like he can't like fly where he wants to fly or something like that. But sanctions by U.S. design are meant to just to hurt people. I mean, the whole strategy of sanctions, the entire reason that the U.S. sanctions any country, and we have a lot of examples, Cuba, Venezuela, Iran, the entire point, North Korea, the entire point is to make life so difficult for regular people that they just put so much political pressure on the government that that's the political leverage that the U.S. have. And so by design, they hurt innocent people, civilians, in particular, the most vulnerable people, older people, babies and things like that. And so, you know, it's unfortunate with the Russia thing that we see the regurgitation of very old debunked ideas. I mean, in the case of Iraq, as a tweet said, the results of the U.S. sanctions were genocidal, and there's really no other way to put it. And that would be the same case in Russia and everywhere else that it doesn't.
And I want to get back to talking a little bit more about the Ukraine-Russia stuff with you, because I'm really interested in your perspective there, because it has been sort of fascinating to watch, like, the way that it's being, like, the headlines around it versus the actual facts on the ground. But I just wanted to add to the sanctions bit, you know? It's honestly... one of the most, and it's horrible because it's murderous and genocidal, but like one of the most kind of liberal things, like, well, we wrote these sanctions to be very specific, to touch this and that, right? And oftentimes one was presented is not actually what's on the books. And two, you're basically saying we are creating a legal apparatus as one of the most powerful countries in the world, the economic powerhouse of the world, that if you want to do business with the United States government without having us harass you or come at you, you know, you can't break any of these kind of rules. So we, you know, ends up happening from companies or organizations that, you know, do trade or business with those with, you know, in Iran or potentially Russia, they say, oh, we're not going to do business there because we don't want to end up on the wrong side of the American, you know, sanctions. Right. I mean, this is something that happens in Iran right now when they're saying like, oh, well, these things don't prevent, you know, certain kinds of medical equipment and things like that. Well, what ends up happening is people just walk away from the table because they don't want to do business with Iran and face punishment from the American government.
Yeah, no, it asphyxiates the economy. I mean, it just, and it blocks essential things, medicine, food, you know, and, you know, like I've seen firsthand, like the effects of what these sanctions do, in particular in Venezuela. I mean, completely crushed by sanctions. And if it wasn't for the kind of extremely heightened and mass political consciousness of working class people in that country, that the sanctions would have been successful. It's the same thing for Cuba. It's the same thing for Iran and Korea. It's like, the sanctions are extremely effective and work unless you have developed a very strong and robust and active politically conscious population. And so really like, you know, like governments that don't involve the people, like, can't really survive the impact of sanctions because, you know, they're going to become the target. And so that's the only reason countries have been able to survive against all odds and, you know, barely surviving and a lot of people not surviving. But I think that, you know, another thing for people to understand about the situation with Russia and Ukraine is that, like, this is the U.S. doctrine is to escalate war with Russia and with China. Ever since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, which, you know, collapsed itself. I mean, you know, Russia was the first country in the Soviet Union to leave the Soviet Union, and then the rest of it, of course, collapsed. But ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States said we can never allow a power as big as the Soviet Union ever again. We can never allow a competitor like that ever again. And actually, in the U.S. National Defense Strategy Doctrine, which anyone can read, you know, it says, I actually can quote it, principal priority is to counter Russia and China as competitors. And the way to do that is sustained investment in lethal force. And so when we hear the U.S., and in fact, the Pentagon specifically, say we need to make sure that Russia and China are countered as competitors, they're talking about economic competitors. I mean, they're not talking about Russia is going to attack us unless we develop our military. China is never going to attack the U.S. Russia is never going to attack the U.S. That's the kind of thing that generals in the Pentagon dream of doing, but no other country seriously wants to just start a random war with a big, powerful country and cause a disaster. The U.S. has proven that that's a pretty bad path to take to develop your country. And so the U.S. has in its doctrine to prevent Russia and China from being real economic competitors. So this is about hegemony of U.S. capitalism, of U.S. banks, of U.S. businesses. And how do they want to counter the economic competition of Russia and China? Well, they say it plainly, the development of lethal force, meaning continually investing and growing your capability to kill a lot of people, and to say, okay, our leverage to make sure that our businesses, our banks, our dollars are going to be going in places instead of China, instead of Russia. The contracts are going to be going to our companies instead of Russian Chinese companies. The leverage we have is to make killing machines that we can say, well, we'll just kill a lot of your people if you don't, you know, allow us access to this area. And that is just the encapsulation of U.S. policy towards every country everywhere in the world. It's just really nakedly about securing access to markets, resources, cash for U.S. businessmen, and then using the military and the weaponry of the military industrial complex as its, you know, tool with which to do that. I don't think most people would agree with doing that. You know, if American workers knew that that's actually how U.S. foreign policy runs, you know, you would say, you know, that's a bad use of our, you know, majority of our tax dollars.
You know, and I mean, the irony, I guess the irony is the wrong word. The cruelty of it is that, like, the empire is never, like, satisfied, right? Because, you know, so the ideological enemy in the Soviet Union is, like, destroyed. And then the American government has essentially a foreign policy of trying to rub their nose and shit. Afterwards, we prevent democracy from being able to, you know, spring up in that country. We interfere in elections. We always talk about, everyone always talks about, you know, Trump and Putin, but, like, the United States actively interfered in elections in Russia in a way, and while propping up, you know, oligarchs and mass privatization in the country. And I'm sorry, like, if you are anti-Putin, for example, right? If you're an American, you know, liberal who's very worked about Putin, I will tell you, the number one goal you should have for Russia is, when it comes to American policy toward Russia, is for the United States to get as far away as possible, because Putin only is able to exist in the kind of anti-democratic front that the American government has been, you know, a big part of. And on top of that, I wanted to say about what I was saying about the empire never being satisfied. You know, one of the things that is so terrible about the current situation is that, you know, Putin is certainly sitting on top of the state, and he has, you know, people who are extremely wealthy and own a lot of the resources in that country. And what happens with the benefits from those resources? They go to the American and the United Kingdom financial markets and the real estate market. What I'm saying is, like, there's already a funnel of resources out of that part of the world into the West. And it just is, like, if you ever think that you're going to be able to placate empire, just look at how the Americans and the United Kingdom have dealt with Russia post-Soviet Union.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great point, too, because, like, with it's easy to see with China, like, why the capitalist United States, we have to confront China because it's run by communists, and they are operating a foreign policy with a communist ideology and cooperation, all of these things. And it's just like it was in the after World War II, where you had the socialist camp and the capitalist camp, and the world divided into these two poles in the world, and you're with the communists or you were at the capitalist imperialist countries. So, of course, that explains in addition to being a big economic competitor, U.S. hostility towards China. But Russia, you know, after the Soviet Union was overthrown, you know, the U.S., as you mentioned, was very involved in Yeltsin and the presidency and stuff like that. But Russia is a capitalist country now and, you know, kind of a pro-U.S. capitalist country. Like, culturally, like, Russian culture, like, idealizes the U.S., wants to be like the U.S. I mean, there's no, like, hatred of America like you might find in other countries. You know, so it would seem like, well, why doesn't the U.S. just want to ally with Russia? It's a big capitalist country that is probably willing to work with the United States. The reason for that, it just gets back to this issue of U.S. hegemony. So if why wouldn't Russia just become part of NATO then after the overthrow of the Soviet Union? The U.S. wants to gobble up all those other former Soviet republics and make them part of NATO. But why not Russia? And the reason is because the U.S. has to be the leader of NATO. If the U.S. let Russia into NATO, which would, you know, stop any chance of a war between NATO and Russia, obviously, that would mean that Russia, a big, powerful and country with a really deep history, would probably have a lot of influence in NATO. Other European countries in NATO might, you know, align more with Russia. Countries like Germany, especially, which has longstanding historical and cultural relationships with Russia, would probably gravitate more towards Russia as a NATO country. And so it's not just about like the ideological battle of socialism versus capitalism. It's about the U.S. We want capitalist countries in our orbit, but we have to be the most powerful capitalist country. And if there's another capitalist country that might step on our toes a little bit, and us as the great eagle at the top and all of the other imperialist partners are under our wing, you know, we can't accept that. So it exposes that the U.S. is just about its own domination, or its domination of its ruling class.
And I think that that's a really important point, in the sense that, like, one thing that, I mean, this is just me being having some self-reflection. I've been a little sad seeing even some of, like, the kind of, like, left/socialist reaction to the crisis, right? And I don't know, just I think the vast majority of people who are principled socialists on this, I think, have had the right take. But I have seen, you know, this kind of, like, you know, sanctions or, you know, pro-sanction movements, or people saying, well, this time is different, right? This is like Putin is like the real threat to democracy. And I guess for me, as a member of the left, that has made me sad. But I want to make the larger point that what you're seeing, I've just been trying to remind people, it's like, you know, this is one of the good American socialist traditions, like World War One, as it was like the great communist tradition, right, was opposing the imperialist war. And remember that there will always be a story, right? It's the Kaiser, right? Like, there's always like some kind of threat that can be, you know, sort of, you know, pumped out through the media. And I think when you look at Ukraine, and Russia, I think one of the best examples of this is, one, to look at other countries' media, and two, look at the way that it's been sort of talked about in American press, in the sense that, like, this is a ticking time bomb. Okay, there's been some mobilization by Russia on the border, right? But nowhere near the kind of logistical capacity for any kind of like land invasion, right? So when people are sitting here like, there's a picture that's being presented to the American public, right? That there are guys standing there and they're putting the barbed wire on the border and they're ready to charge over it. Like, there is no real logistical capacity for doing any of that. And once you start to see that, like, oh, well, this is being hyped up, then you really need to start challenging and questioning this narrative as to why, you know, this story is sort of being promoted to all of us, that we are, you know, 5 minutes to midnight of a full-on Russian land invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, and you know what you mentioned about how the people are just so inundated with this fear about Putin, and you know, like, it makes sense if you meet people who are like, yeah, I hate that guy, we should do something about him. I mean, this was, you know, back to that example of the Gulf War. I mean, this played out in a big way in the invasion of Iraq in 2003, also, where it was any anti-war voice that got on the mainstream media, because there were mass anti-war protests at the time. The first question that they would be asked would be, well, what do you think about Saddam Hussein? Don't you agree that he's a madman? Don't you agree that he's evil? And if you agree with that, then what do you think something has to be done about him? So if you're not for war, what are you for? What do you think should be done about him? And this again cleaved the anti-war struggle into a liberal and anti-imperialist wings. I mean, anti-imperialist leaders who would go on the news would say, I'm not answering that question. You're trying to trap me into a question to legitimize the war propaganda. Whereas the liberal wing would say, yes, of course, this is horrible. Something's got to be done, but war is not the answer, type of thing. And there was a split in the anti-war movement in 2003 also, and a pretty major one. And of course, the bigger wing, although both wings were pretty massive, bigger wing was led by, you know, Democrats, liberal organizations, and so forth. And that split was over slightly different things, but it came down to that kind of core. That core idea. And so it's a tried and true tactics. That's why the U.S. keeps using them, the boogeyman and everything. But, you know, I think maybe something that more be relatable to people is, do you really want Biden making decisions on whether or not we're going to go into World War III and then being in charge of World War III? It would seem, I think most people would think that's a bad move, no matter who's on the other side.
Also, I would just say, for this is anecdotal, this is my personal experience, but like, I have a hard time seeing most Americans, particularly working class Americans, like actually wanting to see any kind of, you know, American troops going to die and to fight over Ukraine, right? I'm not even making any kind of larger statements other than like, I don't think there actually is that much popular support amongst like the people. So like, there has to be this kind of narrative, you know, that's being promoted. Because I mean, like, liberals have been really, you know, pushing a kind of, you know, Russian phobic like narrative for a long time, but like, and they're very worked up, and they, you know, they're but again, like, I don't think that this is like really trickling down to the vast majority of people, which is why the ticking time bomb, like this kind of the way that this is being sort of pushed on people right now, does make me more worried. Because it's like, okay, there wasn't there's certainly a political agenda from like the U.S. military, from like an imperial perspective of like wanting to protect our hegemony. Then there's a kind of like Russia fixation that has become very popular with people in the media and a lot of American liberals. So then how can you sort of excuse, you know, to an American people who I think are just tired of war and conflict across the board, you know, and the only way to really do that is to try to bring up these old, it's, you know, as I was saying, 5 minutes to midnight, it's Hitler invading Poland kind of thing. And I hope that we're able to push and help people see through that. I have to say, I think that, I don't want to talk too early, obviously, but I do think that like on a popular level, on a national level, I don't find there to be as much hunger as I think people in power would sort of like. And I also have to say, just on top of that, as an internationalist, like, it has also been really encouraging to see just the boredom that a lot of even European countries sort of have with the idea of a hot war. The Germans, of all people, I don't know if people were seeing, but there have been really hilarious like kind of public polling around this, where like pretty much every country is like, well, maybe the EU, you know, or NATO should do something, like 50% of the population saying that. But literally every time they said, should my country do anything, it's like 20%, you know, polling that they think they should do something. So I'm encouraged, at least. That doesn't mean that, you know, popular support isn't what decides if we go to war or not. But I will say, at least there is that kind of consciousness.
Well, I mean, everyone has in very recent memory the U.S. occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. Yeah. And I don't think anyone wants that fate. And so, you know, that's one thing that came out of that was like the example of how actually catastrophic those decisions are.
Yeah, I mean, kind of related to that, and then we'll move on to Afghanistan, but there's that skier who has dual Chinese American citizenship, and everyone is freaking out because she's performing for China. And it's like, and she's not saying nothing about their human rights record. It's like, as if we didn't do the Iraq and Afghanistan just in the past, like, since I've been alive. Like, what are we talking? Like, it's insane.
Yeah, like, are U.S. Olympians expected to, like, speak out about U.S. human rights crimes at the Olympics? I mean, I wish they would, but it's definitely not an expectation. But also, like, that whole hysteria is funny because, like, I definitely remember like past Olympics watching, and like there's tons of Americans that compete on European teams, like white Americans that are like born in Switzerland but grew up in the U.S. and then compete on the Swiss team or whatever. Like, it seems like it's not an abnormal thing for people to like go from where they can't get on the Olympic team and where they're living, and they go to their home country or whatever. Not the case of this person. She got on any Olympic team she wanted, but it's very common. But yeah, I mean, it shows it's relevant to this discussion because it's all of the like programming and propaganda that's necessary to prep people for a war. And as I mentioned, that in the U.S. national security doctrine, it's Russia and China, and everything needs to be focused on confronting them and building up our weaponry and prepping the population for, these are our enemies, and we need to do whatever possible to make sure that they don't become big powers. And so that that bleeds into every element of culture, you know, even the Olympics, sadly.
Yeah. And likewise, when Ned Price said, you know, we have this information, and it's our intelligence partners, and we can't tell you. But it's we. I mean, I haven't been around for that long. Like, even I have the pattern recognition for this stuff. Mm-hmm. Let's move to talk about another sector of the anti-war, the sort of right side, libertarian side. So I do want to credit Josh Hawley saying some agreeable things about NATO recently. I'm a little bit suspicious that if Taiwanese membership in NATO was on the table, that he would maybe change his mind on that. But I want to play this Rand Paul clip from earlier in the day, because Afghanistan is in a lot of trouble because we have freezed its accounts, basically financial warfare continuing where we've withdrawn. And Rand Paul was asked by Ryan Grimm on Rising about, you know, if we should stop that. And this response was, and to tie back to our sanctions discussion, I think pretty grotesque.
And one real quick question on Afghanistan. You've said you don't want the Biden administration offering more aid to Afghanistan, but at the same time, the administration is holding on to $7 billion in assets that belong to the Afghan government, not releasing them back to the central bank as they were before. Do you think that the Biden administration ought to continue holding on to the Afghan assets, or ought to release it back to the Afghan government?
It's probably hard for me to imagine that something we're holding is actually an Afghan asset. We were giving them $50 billion a year. I would think the $7 billion is stuff they owe us. But it also wasn't, it's for a government, this is a government that took over in a military junta. It's not a legitimate elected government. No way in the world would I give them that money. And the thing is we've spent billions and billions, if not trillions there. And I think it's a big mistake. And to reward people, look, as much as I was for leaving, the Taliban agreement, they broke every bit of the agreement. They said they wouldn't advance and they wouldn't take cities until we had gone, and they did anyway. So I think they've broken every agreement we had, and I would put that money back in the treasury. We don't have it to give anyway. I mean, it's, you know, the thing is all it is more borrowed money. So I wouldn't give it to them.
God, I'm sorry. The music at the end is so dystopian, I must say.
Yeah, really. So, yeah, what's your assessment of Biden? And again, that is Rand Paul agreeing with Joe Biden's policy of freezing those assets. Tell us your reaction to what's going on in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, well, it reminds me of like Trump being like, you know, why don't we take Iraq's oil? Like, that's our mm-hmm. oil. Like, we took over the country. It should be ours. So like the arrogance of like, you know, that's our money. That people across Afghanistan in a mass degree are suffering acute malnutrition. And Human Rights Watch just about a week ago released a report saying they're on the brink of a famine, a nationwide famine. That is the impact of the United States seizing billions of dollars of assets from Afghan banks. Of course, all the money that was looted by the U.S. puppets as they fled the country, that was a lot of money too. The United States and the World Bank have imposed really severe sanctions on Afghanistan, in addition to freezing all its assets and looting all its assets. And of course, that's hurting Afghanistan, already like one of the poorest countries on earth. Of course, that's hurting everyone. Social services are collapsing. Everything is collapsing in the country because of the economic warfare of the United States. You know, Rand Paul, this whole like, it's not a legitimate government, they took power in a junta. It's like, this was a negotiated surrender. The United States negotiated their own surrender, and the Taliban actually, you know, protected them on their way out. This whole, oh, they didn't come into cities. They said they wouldn't come into cities until we were gone. If the Taliban didn't come into Kabul before the U.S. was gone, there would have been a lot more attacks like the one we saw that was the deadliest attack of the entire Afghan war for U.S. forces. And it was Taliban doing security, covering the retreat of the United States. But, you know, I will say that... you know, it's funny because Rand Paul, too, he's the one that throughout the entire when Trump was elected was like, finally, we have an anti-war president. That was Rand Paul's line, and like bringing the libertarian world into Trumpdom by saying he's the first anti-war president we've ever had. Obviously, a load of BS seeing what Trump did. But I will I think that Biden's approach to Afghanistan, while it's genocidal, the sanctions regime and the freezing of assets, which just should immediately be released. I mean, like if you don't want to hurt innocent people, release the assets. But they do want to hurt innocent people. I think that the U.S. knew it needed to leave Afghanistan for a long time. One of the reasons that the defeat took so long is because, you know, what general, what president wants to take responsibility for a lost war? It was pretty obvious for a very long time that There is no way for the U.S. to leave without a total Taliban takeover. And so, you know, Trump was possibly going to be the person that ended the Afghanistan. I mean, he was saying that he's going to do it. Lots of people were saying he was going to do it. But when it came down to it, he was probably like, do I really want to be the guy that had the big Afghanistan disaster happen on his watch? So he kicked it down the line to Biden. And I think that what the Pentagon wanted to leave, I mean, it was a clear military defeat. They couldn't really sustain it. And they needed to do what Obama came in and did in 2008, which was we need to pivot to Asia. We're bogged down in these wars that we shouldn't be fighting. And the real focus is China. We need to pivot to China. And so the Pentagon very much is on that page, too. So much so that as soon as the withdrawal happened, it like all the training switched to war with China for people inside the military, and in particular in the special forces. So the Pentagon knew it needed to leave. Of course, it needed a partner to leave, really someone who is going to be willing to be president when it all collapsed into a huge disaster that they knew was inevitable and knew was inevitable for probably about 15 years of the war. So for Biden, I mean, I don't know how conscious he is about his decisions as a president. I mean, he doesn't seem that. I feel like he was like the perfect person to come in and say, okay, you know, we can continue with the Pentagon's withdrawal plan. I mean, the fact that that plan for the U.S. exit was constant through the Trump and Biden administrations. It wasn't the Trump plan. It wasn't the Biden plan. It was the Pentagon plan. They wanted that to happen. And, you know, after so many administrations, Biden was just the one that wasn't going to continue to kick the can down the line. I don't think that's because he's good in any way. Maybe he didn't even know what was happening. But, you know, it was this is the same reason the Vietnam War dragged on for a long time. Because no one wanted to take responsibility. None of the generals wanted to say, this is lost, we got to get the fuck out of here. No president wanted to be like, we've lost and I'm going to surrender. And so they just, the bulk of the Afghanistan war, after the troop surge that Obama did, the U.S. has been retreating slowly since then for about 12 years, a 12-year long retreat, paving the way with bodies and limbs of Afghan civilians and, of course, U.S. soldiers as well. And so it was something that's going to haunt Biden for sure. But I think that if there's anything he can do to make it right, it would be just continuing to wage war on the country, you know, through economic means.
Yeah. I mean, there's such a cruelty with the U.S. holding money and preventing essentially like, you know, international aid from coming into the country too. I don't know, creating a scenario where you're like, well, see, you guys thought that the occupation was so bad. Look what happens when the Taliban is in power. And look, of course, like the Taliban, you know, extremely reactionary, you know, like it is a force, you know, to oppose it if there ever is one. But to deny aid to people, to human beings, because of the government, because of the people who hold power over them, I think is one of the most inhumane things that you can do if your actual goal is to sort of challenge those in power in that society.
I mean, they've just suffered so much for the last 20 years. I mean, it's horrible. I mean, and it's of course, the violence has drastically reduced, but the suffering is still catastrophic, and it's because of the U.S. I mean, and it's that's our real legacy there. And this is the fact that it's continuing is really criminal, and you know, warfare by a different means, unfortunately.
So, can I ask you, you know, just because we're sort of talking about it both with the history of the anti-war movement in this country with that Rand Paul clip right there. I mean, how can we sort of work through this, right? Because, you know, there's a part of me that's like, okay, we want to build coalitions that can, you know, challenge the empire, challenge this machine. But you do see where, like, you know, you might be against the war, but if we're coming at it from very different reasons, particularly if you're a libertarian, you're literally just worried about how much it's costing the U.S. Treasury, right? Very, very different perspectives here. I mean, you know, what is the answer here? I mean, you know, is it just that we need to be better at making our case, that we need to be bolstering our numbers in general? You know, does Rand Paul, for example, like represent, you know, a very embedded part of like the libertarian movement? I know, you know, like, you know, there's all of these different, you know, groups that sometimes show up to anti-war protests in my experience. And, you know, when you're there, you're like, okay, well, this is great. We got people in the streets, but then obviously on the other side, in the political movements, we have to ask questions like, well, what do you really want on the other side? And you can see how quickly people who you're marching with one week are the next week, you know, doing the pro-sanctions march, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few different like components of that. I mean, there's like the people in power who pose to be the anti-war Republicans, right? Mm-hmm. Tucker Carlson is the leader, and then other Republican Congress people like Matt Gaetz, you know, they're all anti-war because they're denouncing the Russia stuff. They said we got to get out of Afghanistan, you know, and they use it. But they're all very pro-war with China. I mean, that's also actually mm-hmm. their whole rationale for why we should de-escalate with Russia so we can escalate with China. And so those people in no way are potential allies at all. Like, if you're just saying, let's not go to war here, let's go to war there, or let's increase sanctions, you know, like that's not serious for people who look at the world like we do. I mean, there's the general question of like libertarians. I mean, do they have a place in the anti-war? Like, I joined the anti-war struggle when I got out of the military in 2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. Of course, there was libertarians coming to the anti-war demonstrations and libertarian groups or whatever mobilizing for them, you know, and that's great. That's cool. In terms of like the giving political leadership and character to struggles that we build, though, you know, unity is like built on principles, and coalitions mm-hmm. are built on principles. And now, how do you actually reach the broad sectors of working class and oppressed people that you need to build a strong anti-war movement? And of course, that involves addressing racism as kind of a first and foremost thing, and the understanding that these wars are racist wars and have racist components to them, and issues of economic inequality, and that how that's the wars are just a boon for the military industrial complex while working people suffer and things like that. And so those are kind of points of unity that coalitions, real vibrant working class coalitions, are built around that like the anti-war right, you know, can't be a part of. And it's like going back to this idea about like liberals and anti-imperialists like splitting, which was always the desire of the liberals to split. Like the mm-hmm. anti-imperialists and anti-war coalitions always tried to make concessions to the liberal wing, but it was the liberals that, like, we don't want these communists in any kind of leadership position here. But I think that it's, if we're looking about like uniting with people like Rand Paul and Tucker Carlson to build an anti-war movement, I mean, how are you going to get people to join that who are immigrants, who are African-American, who are of the LGBT? Like, there's so many important groups of people in this country represented by strong and powerful organizations that you want to build coalitions with that, you know, rightfully so, could not accept that and should not accept that. So it's always like, I mean, there's always this hypothetical of like, can we build a left-right anti-war coalition? Like, and that's like, I'm not concerned with that. I'm concerned with reaching the people that aren't reached by either right now.
Yeah.
Like there's, yeah, like the anti-war right, this like whatever niche.
Well, so I mean, I feel like a bit of that is like a bit of a misnomer too, right? In the sense Absolutely. That like, you know, there's people who like, I mean, I was talking to some friends about this the other day. I meet people, you know, cause I'm in Texas, I'm in the South. So like a lot of people that they're not, I don't know, like, they don't want to be left because of the aesthetics of it, right? But, you know, there's a lot of people who, like, generally, like, they're anti-war, they're against these things. It's like, they might say that they like a Ron Paul character. And literally, it's because he's anti-war. So I always say that, like, well, what we should be doing, instead of being like, me being like, well, you know, Ron Paul, oh, I love Ron Paul, he's my boy. You know, so it's like, well, you know, here's, like, a really strong, growing movement of, like, people like us who are doing anti-war. I don't know.
Who take your concerns like, seriously.
Because like, at the end of the day, when we're talking about any kind of hypothetical, like, left-right alliance, I would say, what you're really talking about is the people. You know, like I don't need Rand Paul to show up at my meeting. Frankly, I wouldn't want him to, unless he's with his neighbor. But, you know, like I'm much more worried about maybe some of the normal people who I've seen in my community might get into somebody like a Rand Paul because, oh, he's anti-war, and just bring him to our side that is like much more committed to an anti-war, internationalist, anti-racist position.
Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, and this is like a thing, you know, like there's always been this like right wing isolationism mm-hmm. as like a foreign policy where they think that it's all about, you know, America. It's like the America First stuff, which Trump just used in his rhetoric, but, you know, still bombed like every place that he could to the, you know, 10 times what his predecessor did. And right wing isolationism is all about like you know, we don't want our good American boys going over there and dying to like help these ungrateful people. Then we should, you know, like stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, yeah. It's, but we want to promote internationalism, not just we shouldn't send our boys to go die, but the idea that we have a lot in common with the people that we're told are our enemies. We have a lot in common with people in China, in Russia, and everywhere else, in Iran, in Cuba, in Venezuela, all the places we're told are our enemies. We have far more in common with them than like extremely, extremely rich people like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and people like that. Like those are people that we actually have nothing in common with at all. And I think that's something that resonates much more with this idea that why would we go help people in Iraq and waste our American blood helping people in Iraq and playing into that lie when we can, you know, help people here. I think it is impactful and meaningful to people to feel that that they're part of a class that is global and they have kind of common enemies, the people who aren't part of our class.
Yeah.
Now, Mike, when people go to follow you at Mike Prisner, right, they will see your name is Shutdown Red Hill. And I want to get your take on this very quickly, because I think this is an amazing example of what American Empire delivers to everyday people, the myth versus the reality. So this is nearby Pearl Harbor. And we have some news here I want to get your reaction to. Senator Brian Schatz announced $100 million in federal funds to defuel the Red Hill bulk fuel storage facility on the island of Oahu. I want your opinion on this, but before I do that, I want to also put up this article from 1978. It is, let's see, one second. Here it is. So this is from 1978. Dillingham gets fuel tanks job. Dillingham Corporation has been awarded $19.9 million contract to renovate the Navy fuel storage facility at Red Hill. And this is just a 1978 article saying what we know now, which is that these deteriorated condition of the storage tanks threaten to pollute Red Hill's underground water reservoir, which provides, you know, all this. So what's your reaction to the funds and give us the Red Hill story that people should know?
Yeah. And the journalist you just shared, Christine, she's been doing incredible work on the Red Hill crisis. Everyone should follow her. People like Oahu Water Protectors, Sierra Club of Hawaii, like are really putting out important information on this. It's something everyone should care about. I think to really understand what's happening at Red Hill, you got to go back to the origins of Hawaii being a part of the United States. Hawaii was a sovereign kingdom. You know, it had kind of played the diplomacy game and been recognized as a sovereign kingdom by British powers and so forth. And so it was a sovereign government. It was a progressive monarchy. I think when people hear queen, that they had a queen, they think like, you know, the Queen of England, but that's not really the case. And, you know, Hawaii was, of course, an incredible place. And Pearl Harbor, which was not always called that, but that was known as the breadbasket of Oahu, the island of Oahu. It was nothing but fisheries and places where people got, it was like all of the food of the island came from this place. It was super advanced and developed in the ways of working in harmony with the ecosystem to extract massive amounts of food for the people on the island and also live at peace and harmony with the environment where it was so sustainable. And this was, it's hard to overstate how important Pearl Harbor was to the island of Oahu and to Hawaiians. The United States saw Pearl Harbor and said, this is a really good place to park aircraft carriers and to park naval destroyers. So in 1895, they sent the Navy to Hawaii and they carried out their first first regime change operation where they took guns, they surrounded the presidential palace and they said, the US is in charge now. Mm-hmm. And they, what they immediately did is they immediately went into Pearl Harbor and just dredged it all out. They just destroyed it. They destroyed all the fisheries. They destroyed all the wildlife. And they just, you can't eat a single piece of seafood, from Pearl Harbor. Now there's signs all around it saying it's poison. Do not even go in the water. It's, and so that is how the US military started in Hawaii and on Oahu specifically. And then every day since, that's the way they've operated. About 25% of the island of Oahu is occupied by the U.S. military. Some of this in the form of just like there's one entire island off Oahu that is, the entire island is just a bombing range for the United States. And this is an important place for Hawaiians. Hawaii was never legally annexed. I mean, even as the U.S. came and overthrew it, the queen was playing the game of diplomacy. And instead of a call to arms of the people to rise up and go to war against the U.S. military, they actually made legal appeals, and those legal appeals were deemed legitimate. And so it's illegally occupied. It was illegally annexed, and Hawaii should be returned, restored to the Hawaiian people. The U.S. military should leave. But so much of the island is taken over by the U.S. military and just dumped on. I mean, it's just treated with just such just disregard for the environment, for human life. And so Red Hill is just part of that long history of just the military just destroying it for the purposes of having. And this was the first step for the U.S. becoming a big global empire. Stepping out off the continent, once they had conquered all of the continental United States through wars of aggression against native peoples, then they started stepping out. And stepping out to Pearl Harbor was very important for the empire. And then from there, they're able to project their power all throughout the Pacific, all throughout Oceania. And that was the reason for doing it. And so Red Hill was the fuel storage tanks to complete this mission, to get fuel to all the ships in Pearl Harbor, to send them elsewhere in the world, to kill people, to expand the U.S. empire. Now, these fuel tanks, it's just a quick rundown. It's like, you know, many, many millions, like 25 million gallons, or maybe it's more, 200 million gallons of fuel, always stored in these tanks. The tanks are literally underground, right above the main aquifer in Hawaii, which means that when fuel spills from the tanks, it gets seeped into the aquifer and then just goes everywhere in the island. They've known this could potentially cause irreversible damage. I mean, it could cause the permanent loss of this aquifer. And we have an aquifer that's like over 20% of fresh water on the island of Oahu. If that's destroyed, I mean, life will never be the same on Oahu. I mean, you won't be able to take showers with high pressure. Yeah. You'll have to do water conservation all the time. It is just such an important, precious resource that Hawaii is lucky to have this such a huge resource of fresh water, completely destroying it. So there is a leak a few months ago, and it just shows how much the U.S. doesn't care about human life. Is the leak actually poisoned their own sailors, their own service members? The leak got into the water on their bases, and the Navy lied about it. They covered it up. They said, keep drinking the water, keep showering, keep using it, the water to make formula for your babies. And then just emergency rooms got flooded with people with horrible health effects. A lot of pets died, which was a really sad consequence of it, as everyone just started putting their dogs down because the vets were saying, we don't know why your dogs are so sick. And so it was a really horrible thing. And the Navy just lied about it, covered it up. So then to get to what your point about how Schultz, congressman, secured $100 million in funds to defuel the tanks, what's happening is like a really incredible example of how the military really is above government in this country, how the Pentagon is above our democratic institutions. The government of Hawaii, the governor, the Department of Health, the Board of Water Supply has said to the Navy, issued an order from the state of Hawaii, you have to get the fuel out of the tanks. You have to do it. They said you have 30 days to come up with a plan to get all the fuel out of the tanks because the water's still poisoned right now. Schools still don't have water. It's still leaking. It's like a huge disaster. But as long as those tanks are there, we are on the precipice of a major disaster, or at least until they defuel the tanks and repair them. But they should just be taken out altogether. So the Hawaii said you have 30 days to come up with just a plan. You don't even have to take 30 days to defuel them. In 30 days, come back with a plan to defuel the tanks. So a couple days ago, that deadline passed. And instead of producing a plan, the Navy produced basically a legal suit saying we're challenging this in court and we're actually not going to do this. Wow. And so Schultz, he was quiet on this for way too long. I mean, he was quiet until he didn't have to be quiet anymore, or when he couldn't be quiet anymore. $100 million secured for the defueling, but it doesn't matter because the Navy's not doing it. Schultz also notably secured like $103 million for some new military radar to be put on Oahu. He secured over $300 million for some new military aircraft facilities on Oahu. So, you know, he's no stranger to securing massive amounts of federal funds for the military. Maybe why he gets a lot of money from defense contractors like Lockheed Martin and so forth. But really the situation with Red Hill now is the fuel's still there. It's still, we don't know how much has leaked. We don't know where it is. There's still wells shut down. It's still a major water crisis on the island. So there's just that, dealing with what's happened in the past, that this leak happened. It's not cleaned up. But then this massive struggle on the island to say, as long as this fuel is stored in these tanks, it imperils the entire island and the future of clean drinking water forever on the island. And so it's just a really, and then so you have like the Hawaiian government trying to tell the military what to do. The military is not listening to them. But then, of course, you have Native Hawaiians who are fighting their government for stronger things. And so it's fighting for sovereignty, fighting for their own land. And really, my experience going there, I mean, it's just such a militarized place. I mean, you fly into Oahu and there's fighter jets on the tarmac where my airplane landed, the civilian airplane. It's like, it's wild. I mean, the whole island is taken over by the military. And then you have Native Hawaiians who don't have access to any land at all. It's their country. They have nothing. And yet the military is able to just train on it, shoot bombs into wherever they want, and so forth. And so it's really tragic, but it's something that I think is becoming a big scandal for the Navy and for the Department of Defense. And so it's something that if everyone does what they can to connect with the people that are organizing in Hawaii, putting pressure on Biden, putting pressure on the Navy, this could turn into a bigger scandal. I think it was a big scandal when the leak first happened, because you had all of these soldiers and military families who are covered in rashes and in the ER, and their babies all sick in the hospital. It was a compelling thing. But this is the potential for this to grow into a crisis that really is like the forefront of addressing the U.S. military's destruction of the environment. You know, Red Hill really could become that flashpoint. And so I think it's something that really everyone should do their best to learn about and care about.
Yeah, we'll link to your report, Native Hawaiians Fight U.S. Navy for Polluting Island Water, from December. And yeah, there's Instagram, Oahu Water Protectors. There's some links in the notes there so people can get there. But Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Truly. And, you know, we have links also to how you can follow Mike, and also his work at Empire Files is absolutely indispensable. Truly, it's an honor to speak to you tonight. So thank you so much for being generous.
And I love what you guys do too.
Thanks, Mike.
See you guys soon. Bye-bye.
That was great. That was,
that was a lot of fun. It was nutritious, as we were saying in the beginning.
It was, yeah.
I didn't want to, you know, praise him too much to embarrass him when he was on camera, but, his work in general is amazing. I remember before doing any of this, watching some of his anti-war speeches, it was really great to talk to him. And most recently, I mean, this, I think the attention that they've brought to this issue has been really, really a major role in why more and more people are talking about it. So this is why I'm, you know, continuing to share their work and awareness of what's happening in Hawaii, I think, is very, very crucial and can hopefully lead to a better settlement.
And it's so wild to me, because like I think of the way like my grandpa, who didn't serve in any combat, but was in the military as a young guy, this is after World War II, but like the way like he traveled to Pearl Harbor, right? Mm-hmm. And it has this like iconic sort of, it's like a pilgrimage for guys who love the military
and the Navy.
And we're fucking poisoning it to the point the island isn't going to be inhabited unless we do something.
Well, the cruel thing about it is like, I don't have anything other than to, you know, larger point other than just say, it's just so cruel what the U.S. military and the U.S. government does to Native peoples in this country, particularly with like finding really special spiritual and holy sites. And just occupying them and using them. I mean, Hawaii unfortunately is not alone in that, but it's absolutely. And people should, if you aren't familiar, and maybe we should do a longer segment on this in the future. Like, people should look into the annexation of Hawaii, because it is one of the most clear cut scandals ever. All of the theft of Native land, obviously, is stained in a. With blood and genocide. But effectively what happens is you had some like preachers and missionaries getting together and saying like, we have announced our independence as a society, right? And it was supposed to be like, we're now like a revolutionary democratic society. Again, like these were just like white settlers, probably around like 25 of them on an island filled with people saying, oh, we're independent. We need the United States government to come in here and, you know, save the day. I mean, just unbelievably clear as day land theft right in front of your eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really is. I mean, you know, you look at fucking Mount Rushmore in the Black Hills, yeah. or you look at like the place of, you know, people say that South Africa first concentration camps. You look at the ones that the Dakota were kept at on one of their holy sites at the where the Mississippi splits from the Minnesota River, which now you fly over and you land airplanes on. And it reminded me of this whole conversation with Mike reminded me of this quote that Ben includes in his Hitchens book from Adolf Reed. The Adolf Reed article, "The Whole Country is the Reichstag." Once in an argument in a Washington, D.C. bar with Christopher Hitchens during the Afghan War, I asserted that no place in the world had been made better by the presence of the 82nd Airborne Division, not even Fayetteville, North Carolina, its home base. That stopped Hitchens in his tracks. And, like, I mean, you see, if they're willing to do that to fucking Pearl Harbor, what are they doing to the base by your community?
It's Fayetteville, Matt.
Fightville.
Sorry. Coastal elitist over here. Matt's a Dakota elitist. He's like, if it's not a Midwestern place.
We don't have a Fightville in North Dakota. Fayetteville.
Well, before we get to Andrew, what?
Which one is it? I've
Dakota. Well, it's Fayetteville.
Fayetteville. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Sorry, Fayetteville. No, lots of love to our friends in North Carolina, but not as much to our friends in South Carolina. before we get to this, did we want to do a little this Bitcoin scam thing, or did we want to do that for the post game? What do you think?
Let's save that to the post game.
All right, we're going to bring that to the post game, folks.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to refill my glass for this one. These ramps are almost as bad as the initial crime of stealing from folks and the money laundering. We're going to be taking a little bit of a deep dive into that. I put the link up for people on YouTube, or at least I made a comment in the chat that has our phone number. So be sure to leave us a voicemail for the patrons only post game. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. But before that, we have this interview with Andrew Hairston, which I'm really excited to share with y'all.
Yeah, I also just want to tease real quick. We got another, you know, in the luxury, folks of Left Reckoning's past will have been familiar with the upscale luxury Instagram account.
Mm-hmm. Oh, shit, I forgot about that.
We'll be introducing folks to the Daily Trader Instagram account, a different type of luxury lifestyle. Does your PJ have Fiji? Is the question that all the people are asking.
And Matt will answer what his favorite bottled water brand is as well.
I really don't like
it. And also, before, you know, while we're pitching, we got a really fun thing coming up this Sunday, too.
Oh, yeah. Aaron from Trillbillies at Paradoomer on
Drip God Twitter. Himself.
Yeah, we'll be talking about his great Substack piece about nostalgia that was prompted by the watching the Bulls documentary, which really, like, I got to say, like, that – it was like this, everyone went a little bit crazier in the pandemic, right? And like, mm-hmm. you know, we had the tight group. But like that sort of trip down memory lane of like, of nostalgia. Basically, we're going to interrogate nostalgia because we are going to talk about, you know, we go back in history and Left Reckoning, right? And part of this is to kind of undo basically attacks at our historical memory and like false nostalgia, right? But we're going to talk about some of the pitfalls in the sort of mass marketed nostalgia that we get, mass market nostalgia fair. And also he watched Station 11, which I don't know if you saw that, David, but
I've seen a decent amount. I haven't finished it yet, but
I'm a fan of that show. That's I like, you know, I think it's because it really appeals to me as an English nerd, that like Shakespeare would become a rallying point for civilization. Around Lake Michigan, I think that's a really sweet idea. But anyway,
I'm looking forward to this conference as somebody who, from a different angle too, likes the past and retro and vintage things. You know, like all my Pearl Snaps and things like that are all 70s, 80s, 90s kind of vintage. Where I'm really looking forward to sort of talking about what that means in our historical memory with Aaron. To get the post game where we will be listening to your voicemails and doing all these fun things, join us up at patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that conversation. Yeah.
So just to introduce this, Andrew Harrison, he is running for Justice of the Peace, I believe, Lord in heaven, forgive me if I'm getting it wrong, in District 1, in the kind of East Austin area. If I'm wrong about that, I apologize, Andrew. But I really enjoyed having this conversation. I will say, you know, just noting from TMBS and Majority Report, Michael would always say that he doesn't like to talk to candidates because candidate interviews are usually pretty dry and boring. That's not the case at all with Andrew. He has a very inspiring message and kind of idea of how he wants to see his campaign and this movement, you know, sort of build not only power here in Austin, but our kind of working class democratic socialist movement across the country. So I hope you all enjoy it. And Matt and I will see you on the other side. Welcome back, everybody, to Left Reckoning. David Griscom here. I'm really excited to be joined this afternoon by Andrew Harrison, who is a civil rights lawyer who's running here in Austin for Justice of the Peace in District 1. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today, Andrew.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's such an honor to join you, David.
Well, I'm really excited to talk a little bit about this campaign. You know, we talked with Bob Leibel last week about his run for Travis County Commission. And one of the big themes we're getting here is how important it is for democratic socialists and for the left to really take these local races seriously, because you can do a lot of good for people with it. But before we get into the position and you know, the politics around that, could you just introduce people to you? Tell us a little bit about yourself and like what really gets you motivated in politics, social justice, and civil rights?
Totally. Yeah. I'm a Black Southerner and civil rights lawyer, first and foremost. And I've developed this deep zeal for social and racial justice over 30 years, my age, and my professional career. I really went to law school thinking that I would be perhaps a public defender. And then after my second year really commenced, Michael Brown was murdered in Ferguson. So I shifted my focus a bit in my career to more impact litigation and policy work in achieving racial justice. And so in the first few years out of law school in D.C., I really honed in on that passion and then moved to Austin in 2019 to further develop it by working at Texas Appleseed. And I think my understanding of racial justice advocacy in the 21st century, of being a Black lawyer at this time in history, really pushed me in this moment, really in the middle of 2021, to consider running for office as a Democratic Socialist, and has culminated in quite the campaign leading up to the March 1st primary.
I mean, it's certainly been a really exciting campaign to see the response so far. But could you explain to folks who might not be familiar with the position Justice of the Peace, what it sort of is, and why is it important for us as, you know, leftists and democratic socialists to care about?
Totally. So Justice of the Peace is a low-level judge. If you will, it might be the one court that you would most likely be entering if you're a litigant. And it covers, in Texas, in Travis County in particular, things ranging from small claims and misdemeanors all the way to eviction proceedings. And you make a very salient point about the reception of the campaign. We've been blown away just door knocking and chatting with folks in East Travis County to say that twofold, we're going to address the school to prison pipeline by taking on the truancy referrals that land a lot of kids in JP court, right, just further criminalizing their behavior and maybe their absenteeism. And then to look at the eviction proceedings, where even when the CDC eviction moratorium was in place, the incumbent did not fully and zealously honor the tenants of that program and was inclined to evict tenants fairly early on in the pandemic. So, yeah, just to the piece, a pretty low-key role, but significant amount of power.
And it affects a lot, like that's a lot of people's like experience with dealing with the state and the justice system in general, right? And, on, you know, on your end too, I mean, the evictions have been a big part of this campaign along with other really important issues. And I think that's really important because, you know, as we're fighting in other ways to like increase rental protections for people, the current state of play for most folks in Austin compared to other parts of the country when it comes to tenant protections, it's not as great as we'd like it to be.
Totally. Now, what was very interesting for me a couple of weeks ago, the Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court, Nathan Heck, who's a Republican.
Mm-hmm. I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, the New York Times op-ed. So interesting to say that even from our perspective in the judiciary, evictions have grown untenable over the past few decades. And certainly the pandemic has shown a light on just how quickly judges and judicial officers are willing to displace people and take away this vested property right that is their home and plunge them into chaos unnecessarily. You know, reading that op-ed along with Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City by Matthew Desmond is just really shining a light on it does not have to be this way. 65, 70 years ago, it might have been in the community that Matthew Desmond analyzes and Evicted, it's Milwaukee. It's like there were one or two evictions per week, right? Mm-hmm. And at the stage that he's writing the book, maybe in 2008, 2009, it's several per day in specific neighborhoods. So, yeah, I think, you know, we got to understand now that this is a critical point for folks 2 years into the pandemic, kind of with a broad recognition that folks do not have to be displaced from their homes and it doesn't have to be done so callously.
Yeah, and it is not helpful. I mean, you note on your website, and it's something that I really liked about how you see the position. You said, I see the justice of the peace as an empathetic protector of our neighborhoods and our family when they're in need. I want to keep our children in schools and keep our families in their homes. I mean, you've touched on that a little bit, but could you sort of expand on that? And, you know, particularly, I mean, like, this is changing the way, in my opinion, the way that we can see our government and authority, right? Like if we're putting people in our community who are looking out for working class people, for people of color in these kind of positions, we don't have this kind of, you know, hard state apparatus that is sadly the experience for most people.
Mm, love this point. Ours is a broad, really revolutionary view of public safety. And admittedly, there was a tension for me because as a socialist, I think I was drawn to run for the position, but I'm also a prison industrial complex abolitionist and working to see the end of policing and prisons in my lifetime, or at least contributed in that black liberatory tradition to the end of these oppressive, brutal systems, right? And the abolitionist part of me was thinking, well, is it worth it to run for elected office, right? I've been kind of sitting with the position and sitting with its roles and responsibilities and kind of understanding it more. It's like we really can have an affirmative vision of public safety where children are allowed to go to schools, where not only they're just existing, but they are thriving, they're flourishing, where their intellectual curiosity is allowed to grow, you know, as much as they want it to and check out various disciplines that they're interested in. And to think about their families, where increasingly because of the brutality of capitalism, a lot of us have had to rely on collective economics and maybe live with multiple generations in our family. To think that if I'm a child, I could have access to my great grandmother, right? And this person could be with me and be an integral part of my rearing. And when she passes on, you know, we know that we have her memories and her home, right, to continue our family legacy and to understand that, you know, many generations into the future will be telling her story, our descendants will be telling our story, right, and we can kind of rely on that safety and assurance.
I mean, I really hear you, and, you know, as somebody who's from Austin and, you know, grew up here, and I've seen just the, you know, people talk about the changes in the sense of like, oh, well, you know, the restaurants have changed. It was like the people have changed. And seeing so many people, you know, really losing their homes, particularly, in East Austin, but even in South Austin where I'm from, you know, we talk about the housing crisis a lot on this program, Left Reckoning, but, you know, could you sort of tell us your perspective on like what the housing situation is in Austin is currently like, and in particular, like the current state of working class renters?
So we saw the New York Times was a big focus of this interview, right? Chief Justice Heck's op-ed. And then in November 2021, the paper published an article to reflect on how expensive Austin is, potentially one of the most expensive cities in the United States at this juncture of history. And you got to understand, You know, me, I've fallen in love with Austin over a 2.5 year period, right? I definitely did. Its allure, you know, have found a deep sense of community, wonderful folks, both in my neighborhood and larger community, who I'm just so honored to be with in this city. But to know that as a working class but salaried person, right, and a single person as I am, you know, there is a kind of precarity to it, right? You know, I'm doing all right now, but, you know, kind of seeing these rising rents, seeing the allure of Austin being made known to many folks who are moving day by day, right? If there are not affirmative programs, to go to that earlier answer, to really stabilize rents, to make sure that folks have access to homes in a way that's not prohibitive and eating up half or more of their paycheck, then we're going to see, unfortunately, mass displacement. And already early in 2022, it's been business as usual in Precinct 1 of JP Court, right? It's like we're in 2019, pre-pandemic, right? Saw reports on Twitter and through other anecdotal forms of evidence that folks are getting put out in the street, in their cars, right? In one of the worst phases of the pandemic with the Omicron surge. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that contextualizes where we are in Austin, right? It's a city of great potential, of wonderful history, but we recognize that if it doesn't have affirmative programs set in place, and that's why I'm so grateful to Bob for running, right, and looking at Commissioner's Court as a way of engagement, then a lot of folks can stand to unnecessarily suffer.
Yeah, and, you know, there's something I said to Bob, too. It's like, you know, when we're talking about displacement and these changes, it's actually not to sit here and be like, you know, Austin's closed and we don't want people to come here. I mean, you're a great example of wonderful folks who have come here. I mean, like, that's why I love being from the city so much, is that it's been like a safe haven and like a refuge for people from all over the state and also from all over the country. And, like, I want that history to continue. What worries me is that you're seeing rents increasing, and then the things that are coming in afterwards aren't for, you know, the people of those neighborhoods, or particularly just people who work for a wage for a living. You know, so I do see these things, like, from what Bob is doing, is sort of dealing with like the income stream of the county and dealing with how we're dealing with big corporations that are moving here, and, you know, working to curb these kind of unfair evictions and bolster our powers, like the other side, to make sure that we can protect, you know, the things that we have from, you know, speculation. But when you're going out in the community, which is, you know, always like a really enriching experience. You know, people get nervous.
People love that.
Sorry.
I canvassed last night. I usually canvass 4 days a week and go and knock on doors for folks. And folks are willing to give me a shot because they're like, oh, you're the man on the door hanger. You're the politician. I'm like, yeah, y'all, I'm that committed to it.
That's beautiful.
Rain, sleet, snow.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's definitely coming down now. Well, I mean, you know, people usually have, like, I understand it because it's a little bit, you know, anxiety-inducing to go and talk to somebody you don't know, knock on their door. But I will tell people that the vast majority of the experiences that you'll have with people are positive. And I'd just be curious to hear, you know, just what people have been sort of saying to you, you know, when you talk to them about what issues matter to them and how they're feeling about the campaign in general.
Yeah. I lead with the school-to-prison pipeline issue, and people are absolutely taken up by it. They want to hear it, you know, whether they are non-parents, whether they are grandparents, whether they're younger voters, right? Folks are really drawn into that message. And I think they understand how the criminalization of young people, especially Black and brown children, LGBTQ young people, and kids with disabilities, has just continually grown over the past several decades. And no meaningful supports have been put into place to give these children an opportunity to thrive in their schools. And so folks have really loved hearing about the plans to put a significant cog in the wheel of the school to prison pipeline by trying to end truancy referrals. There's currently an intergovernmental agreement between four JPs in Travis County and Austin Independent School District, where it's on the books that children who are referred to the truancy system will go to JP Court. But, you know, everything in my power will lead me to push those children right back classrooms and say supports need to be offered to them, especially in this phase of the pandemic. And then the housing piece is very resonant with folks as well. To talk about housing as a human rights framework, right? As a judicial candidate, I'm trying to be mindful of not anticipating specific rulings in particular cases. But to say that housing is a human right, and we have recognition from our top judicial officer in the paper of record that evictions are out of control and have been for a long time before the pandemic. And there is a way to connect everyone with resources, right? We can think of mom and pop landlords. We can think of renters in the city, right? So many tenants where everybody can maintain their home, can be made whole, right? For those landlords who are looking for kind of cash flow. And everybody can thrive. It doesn't have to be a either or situation.
I like that. And, you know, just going back a little bit to the school to prison pipeline aspect, it's like, you know, these things are, and there's some controversy. I know some people don't like, you know, court officials being elected, but I will just say this, like, you know, these things are done in our name as like a democracy, right? And people don't want, I would argue the vast majority of people don't want to see, you know, young kids having this horrible mark on their record being sent, you know, into these unfortunate situations for, again, like, you know, very, very minor infractions that are extremely punitive. And again, like bringing that to the people in this way, I think is very helpful, saying like, do you want this done in the name of your community? Do you want this done to your neighbors? Do you want this done to your neighbors' children? And yeah, I think that's a very powerful message that's been, that seems to be resonating with folks.
Yeah.
Well, in the last couple minutes, I wanted to talk to you, you know, specifically about how you're planning on using this office, right? Particularly as a member of the DSA and of this movement, you know, how are you planning on using this office as a way, you know, to help build community, but also start building a working class power? Because that's a community that has been really left out of the decision-making process, not just in like, you know, like city government and state government, but very directly in our judicial system.
Yeah. I am so proud to be a card-carrying member of Austin DSA and DSA at large. And through the organization, I've gotten an even stronger sense of community. I know I reflected on that in a previous answer, but the opportunity to hone in on organizing skills. I'm a little reticent to call myself an organizer. I think from my time in DC, the organizers I work with are rightfully so, like, y'all are the lawyers, we're the organizers. But honestly, before I started my campaign, and I think that's so real, I'm like, I'm the lawyer.
Yeah.
But I organized for No Way on Prop 8. You know, I was out for a few weeks before the November 2nd election, knocking on doors, talking to folks, saying this unfunded mandate, the superfunding of the police would be disastrous for Austin. You know, it's the furthest thing that we need. And that 69-31 margin, right, a victory for us with No Way on Prop 8 just resonated with folks, right? And then it was a pretty smooth transition into my campaign from there. I think being a member of DSA, I want to be very cognizant of accountability and want to really always uplift working class people. You know, when I was a child, I think my parents were just very supportive, loving folks. I had no idea that money was a finite resource. I think they call it spoiled. I was pretty spoiled. But when I understood that, oh, I have to look at my money in my bank account. If I spend it all, there's no replacement, right? I have, you know, kind of carried that into my life and my advocacy in adulthood, right? And always want to be thinking of particularly Black and brown working class people across the South, right? My people who have done so much, who have gotten the education and worked hard for all these decades, and still at a moment's notice, right, one paycheck away, all of us, from total ruin. And so that analysis will be critical for me in my rulings from the bench of JP Court to understand that working class power is fueling this revolution where we're seeing more and more democratic socialists by the year winning these tremendous elections to, say, council seats, to judicial benches, right, to state legislatures. And we want to continue that momentum and continually uplift those experiences and those voices of working class people as we bring the revolution home.
I love it. Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really exciting time. And I did just want to ask, you know, as you're seeing this campaign go forward, I think that, you know, for people who are in Austin, the influence of Save Austin Now has been really interesting. And particularly what we've seen since the victory last fall, and now going into these primary campaigns, that like there was a moment that it looked like that might be an ascendant movement, but I think a lot of really hard organizing work has sort of weakened their position tremendously so far.
Truly, I reflected on this for In These Times, the February 2022 edition, and I think that, you know, this is kind of the call of the socialist revolution in 2022 is to get liberal folks who are inclined to go toward, you know, Bernie and AOC to see that housing has to be critical in how you analyze these structural issues, right? Mm-hmm. You know, to see Prop B be a defeat for us, right, in DSA and other progressive organizations, it's like, okay, well, we understand that a lot of wealthy white folks just don't want to see people experiencing homelessness. Mm-hmm. But there's this opportunity here with the victory of Prop A that we don't want to superfund the police either, right?
Yeah.
And so there's this space in between. I think your point is well taken, that it's a testament to organizing across years, right? And speaks to the power of organizing and the persistence of it. But yeah, I think that Save Austin Now is in a thankfully precarious position, right? Each election they picked up a candidate or a ballot measure is a more embarrassing defeat. You know?
Yeah.
Election cycle. And yeah, I think we just have to keep up that narrative. Like, not just enough to keep the police funding the same, right? Not just enough, right, to say that you are engaged in philanthropic efforts through your church or private organizations to help people experiencing homelessness. Like, no, the socialist revolution has to really confer the means of production to the working class and make sure that nobody is experiencing this type of displacement. Because truly, across our 100 years of existence, of our humanity, the individual person, it just does not have to be this way. This earth has given us enough abundant resources to live very meaningful, fulfilling lives for the time we're here, and then we can pass it on.
I so agree with it. And I'll tell you, it was interesting to hear, you know, the shift that some people had, because I was doing phone calls, you know, last fall, and I talked to multiple people who voted for the reinstating of the camping ban, and even had donated money to Save Austin Now, who were completely, you know, they didn't regret their vote, but they completely had done a 180 on that organization. And, you know, I think the challenge for us is, you know, out organizing our opponents, but also being able to make people feel like we can get things done. When we say we want housing for all, that we are the group of people that can provide that as a solution, right? It's not just an idea that we have, like we're out there mobilizing, and these kind of victories all build up our capacity, you know, to be able to do that in the future.
We're honored to be a part of it. Yeah.
I'm super stoked. I'm looking forward to it, to seeing the results. So it's the early voting starting soon, correct?
Yeah, 11 days. Early voting starts on Valentine's Day. It will go through the 25th of February, and then March 1st is our day, Election Day.
So I'll put links below for everybody, but you can find the website at hairstonforpeace.com. Andrew's a little shy about this, but he's a huge Cowboys fan, so he scheduled an event on Super Bowl Sunday to protest the Cowboys not making it there, but there's going to be a fundraiser.
He knows nothing about sports. I am a Cowboys fan. David says I am. Yes.
I'm just playing. I believe it's in the afternoon. There are is more information on the website, but Sunday, February 13th, 12:33, there will be a fundraiser too, in the kickoff. So people should definitely check that out if you're in Austin or the Austin area. Is there anything else I missed, Andrew?
David, it's just a great honor. Thank you for this platform, for the work you're doing, and truly solidarity forever.
Absolutely. Take care.
Take care.
That's a great interview. You know, that's what I want in a Justice of the Peace. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm really excited. I can't tell people enough, if you're in the area, to check out the campaign and find ways to get involved or to donate. I mean, this is how we win. And I love Andrew's perspective. And I think that he's walking that good line of like, looking to build our movement and also looking out for people in the community at large. And I was honored to be able to spend time talking with him about that. And I'm also recruiting for my Cowboys constantly. No, we got a hell of a lot more for y'all on the other side. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. We'll be taking voicemails. We're going to be getting into the big crypto heist. I mean, this is the largest heist of all time, isn't it? I mean,
DOJ says it's the largest financial seizure of all time. You're going to love.
Matt and I will be doing, you know, the difficult dance between condemning and sort of being excited to see a kind of modern day heist break out.
Look, we'll get into it, but like, I don't respect that money like I would like people's savings accounts. I think it's funny. I think it's funny that these people stole it, and gave just another example of like why this stuff, you know, is so interesting to people like scammers.
All I hear is somebody who is saying horses are the future and the automobile will pass away as a fad, or the internet's not legit. We have letters.
That's me.
Email. That's all I hear from you, Matt. But
you probably thought the wheel was a dumb idea.
Thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us. You'll be able to see us again about 15 minutes on the post game. Please sign up. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. This conversation with Aaron is going to be really, really good.
Yes.
On nostalgia, reflecting on the politics of nostalgia, what this means for us in our kind of anti-capitalist movements. We're looking forward to sharing that with y'all and much, much more in the future. Thanks, everybody, for supporting us. Thanks, Matt. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Mike, for coming out with us tonight. And we'll see y'all soon.